Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to cover Hosea chapter 10, which I will entitle The Lord Will Punish Northern Israel, Part 2. We will continue the theme that Hosea took up in the last chapter, which is the Northern Israelites, Ephraim, have been very, very bad people, and they're going to get reward for their sins when the Assyrians come in 722 BC and wipe them out. Now, Hosea is prophesying mostly to the northern Israelites. Judah's mentioned every now and then, but it's mostly northern Israel. He's probably in northern Israel, although we don't know for sure. And the time frame is in the 8th century BC, before that 722 date when northern Israel goes down. So we begin now in Hosea 10, verses 1 through 5. Israel is a luxuriant vine. He produces fruit for himself. The more his fruit, the more altars he made. The richer his land, the better he made the sacred pillars. Their heart is faithless. Now they must bear their guilt. The Lord will break down their altars and destroy their sacred pillars. Surely now they will say, "We have no king, for we do not revere the Lord. As for the king, what can he do for us?" They speak mere words. With worthless oaths they make covenants, and judgment sprouts like poisonous weeds in the furrows of the field. The inhabitants of Samaria will fear for the calf of Beth-Aven. Indeed, its people will mourn for it, and its idolatrous priest will cry out over it, over its glory, since it has departed from it. Verse 1, Israel is a luxuriant vine. That's a very common metaphor in the Old Testament. Israel is called a vine many, many times. He produces fruit for himself, in other words, to gain the applause, in other words, to gain the applause and esteem of men, but not to produce fruit for the glory of God. The more his fruit, the more altars he made. He got rich, made a bunch of altars to pagan idols, probably mostly to Baals. The richer his land, the better he made the sacred pillars, like the Asherah poles to Baal's consort Astarte. Their heart is faithless, now they must bear their guilt. The Lord will break down said altars and destroy the aforementioned sacred pillars. The idolatry will not stand. God's going to wipe them out. He's going to wipe out that idolatry when he wipes out Israel in 722. Surely now they will say, "We have no king." Now, what is being referred to here? Option number one, they had no reverence for the king they had, so they could well be said to have no king. We have no king. Just like in America today, I won't mention his name, but we have a president who is not a president. And Americans could say, "We have no president. He's doing nothing. He disappears. He's on vacation all the time." That's option number one. Option number two, this could refer to the interregnum between Pekah, who ruled between 740 and 732, and Hosea, who ruled from 732 to 722. A short interregnum? I don't think so. I think most likely it's option number three. During the invasion of Israel by the Assyrians, Hosea was imprisoned. We read that in 2 Kings 17:4. But the king of Assyria discovered Hosea's conspiracy. Hosea had quit paying tribute to Shalmaneser V. He was not happy, and so he invaded. Continuing in verse 4, 2 Kings 17, he, that's Hosea, had sent envoys to So, king of Egypt, and had not paid tribute money to the king of Assyria as in previous years. Therefore the king of Assyria arrested him, arrested Hosea, and put him in prison. And so now they have no king. So I think that's what's being referred to here. We have no king, for we do not revere the Lord. In other words, they're finally going to admit why they're in such trouble. It's because they have not revered the Lord. As for the king, what can he do for us? Well, if Hosea is in prison, obviously he can't do anything for the northern Israelites. Or it could mean whoever is king. If we had a king, he's not going to be able to stop the Assyrians when they come, because the Assyrians were the big bad boys of the ancient Near East. Verse 4, they speak mere words. That's the northern Israelites. With worthless oaths they make covenants. They swear, but they don't mean what they swear. Judgment sprouts like poisonous weeds in the furrows of the field. A couple of options as to what these weeds are. Option number one, these judgments that sprout are unjust judgments of Israel's courts against the people of northern Israel. So poisonous, unjust judgments sprout everywhere. It's option number one. Option number two, it's God's judgments against Israel. And judgment sprouts like poisonous weeds. It's God's judgments against Israel that are sprouting up everywhere, and I tend to think that's what is meant here. Verse 5, the inhabitants of Samaria will fear for the calf of Beth-Aven. The calf, of course, is the golden calf. Beth-Aven is Bethel. Beth-Aven means house of wickedness, which was the name given by Hosea to Bethel, which means house of God, famous city right north of Jerusalem. And, of course, Dan and Bethel were the places where Jeroboam I, when he split away from the southern kingdom and established the northern kingdom of Ephraim, Jeroboam I put a golden calf in a sanctuary at Dan in the north and in a sanctuary in Bethel in the south. And now Hosea calls it here the calf of Beth-Aven, the calf that's in the house of wickedness. The inhabitants of Samaria, Samaria is the capital city of Ephraim, and thus the capital city of northern Israel. They're going to fear for that calf at Beth-Aven, at Bethel, because the Assyrians are going to come and take it away, because it's golden. And besides, conquering nations in the ancient Near East always took the gods of their conquered territories. That was standard operating procedure. So the people of Samaria are going to mourn for that calf, and its idolatrous priests will cry out over it, over its glory, since it has departed from it. No glory when you're conquered. We go now to Hosea 10, verses 6 through 9. The thing itself will be carried to Assyria as tribute to King Jareb. Ephraim will be seized with shame, and Israel will be ashamed of its own counsel. Samaria will be cut off with her king like a stick on the surface of the water. Also the high places of Avon, the sin of Israel, will be destroyed. Thorn and thistle will grow on their altars. Then they will say to the mountains, cover us, and to the hills, fall on us. From the days of Gibeah you have sinned, O Israel. There they stand. Will not the battle against the sons of iniquity overtake them in Gibeah? Now there's lots of references here that the average English reader will read and not understand, so let's examine this a little closer. Verse 6, the thing itself will be carried to Assyria. Options as to what that thing is that will be carried to Assyria. Option number 1, Israel itself. This is from the Institute for Creation Research. Israel was carried into captivity for a tribute to the king of Assyria. So in verse 6, Israel will be carried to Assyria as tribute to King Jareb. I don't think that's what it is. I think it's the most obvious reference to the golden calf of Beth-Aven, which was just mentioned previously in verse 5. The thing itself, the golden calf, will be carried to Assyria as tribute to the Assyrian king. Adam Clark says concerning this golden calf that it seems that Menachem, who ruled northern Israel from 752 to 742, gave the golden calf to Tiglath-Pileser III of Assyria. Tiglath-Pileser III ruled from 745 to 727. Menachem was trying to buy Tiglath-Pileser III's help and gave the golden calf. Now, I don't know how Clark knows that. I don't think that's in the scripture. But at any rate, the Assyrians are going to end up with that golden calf. So much for that god. Now, if the golden calf is carried to Assyria as tribute, to which king was it presented? King Jareb. Now, there's no such person as King Jareb. As Adam Clark says, if this is a proper name, the person intended is not known in history. The Institute for Christian Research says that Jareb means the contentious one. Let me give you some other translations. Holman Christian Study Bible, Bible in Basic English, God's Word, and the New American Bible says it's the great king. So the golden calf as tribute will be given to the great king of Assyria, and that solves the problem right there because we don't have to worry about which of the great Assyrian kings is referenced. The Holman Christian Study Bible note says it's to King Jareb, which is the same thing as Jareb, just a different way of pronouncing the yod. The American Standard Version, Darby, and the King James Version say it's King Jareb, just like the NASB, which I quoted to you. The Young's Literal Translation says the tribute will be presented to a warlike king. But we're just going to say the great king and not worry about who it is. This Jareb was mentioned earlier in Hosea 5:13, when Ephraim saw his sickness and Judah his wound, then Ephraim went to Assyria and sent to King Jareb, but he is unable to heal you. So he's an Assyrian king, the great king, the contentious king. Now let me give you some options that commentators have used to speculate about who this Jareb is. John Gill says that Jareb is another name for an Assyrian king, either Tiglath-Pileser III or Shalmaneser V. Institute for Creation Research says it's probably Shalmaneser V, whereas Adam Clark said it's most likely that it's Tiglath-Pileser III. Option number 2, it's a place name in Assyria, so the verse should read, the king of Jareb, a place. Other speculations have it. Option number 3, that Jareb is Assyria itself, so it's the king of Assyria. Adam Clark says the word should be translated directly into defender, so it should read, the tribute was sent to the Assyrian king, their defender. Sent to the king, their defender, i.e. the defender of the Assyrians. All of that is highly speculative. We're just going to say it's the king of Assyria. Ephraim will be seized with shame, and Israel will be ashamed of its own counsel. In other words, the officers of the king will advise on how to deal with Assyria, and it will be of no use. Verse 7, Samaria will be cut off with her king. Now, Samaria being cut off is obvious. 722, the Assyrians came in. The king being cut off is not exactly clear. If we're talking about Samaria being cut off in 722, then the king that's cut off would be Hosea. The king who would be cut off would be Hosea. We don't know how Hosea died, so the cutting off would not be kill. So the cutting off would not be a killing of Hosea, but rather his loss of the kingdom. And I think that's the simplest way to put it. Some people say the cutting off refers to the assassination of various kings right before the end of the northern Israel kingdom. For example, Shalom in 752 was assassinated. Pekahiah, who ruled from 742 to 740, he was assassinated in 740. Then Pekah, who ruled from 740 to 732, Pekah was assassinated in 732. In fact, was killed by Hosea, the last king of Israel. I think it's easier just to say Samaria would be cut off with her king in 722 like a stick on the surface of the water. Now, that stick is variously translated. Many translations have foam. The Holman Christian Study Bible puts it as foam with a marginal note saying stick. But whether it's foam or a stick, if you think about a stick floating in the ocean or foam on the ocean, the foam doesn't stay there very long. The stick doesn't stay there very long. It gets tossed to and fro. It's not rooted, just like the king of Samaria will not be rooted. Hosea will not be rooted. He'll be put into prison. He'll get blown away, just like foam. Verse 8, also the high places of Avon. Of course, Avon means wickedness, evil. And Avon is just short for the house of Avon, Beth Avon, Beit Avon, will be destroyed. And that means the golden calf worship of Bethel will be gone. Thorn and thistle will grow on their altars. Then they will say to the mountains, cover us, and to the hills, fall on us. The they being the northern Israelites. When you say to a mountain, fall on you, you're in pretty bad shape. Because if you get a mountain to fall on you, that mountain's going to crush you. But that's better than getting conquered by the Assyrians. Verse 9, from the days of Gibeah you have sinned, O Israel, says Hosea. That Gibeah is a reference to the horrible incident that happened when, near the end of the book of Judges, a man came to seek hospitality of an old man. The old man invited the guest and his concubine in, and then some homosexual people showed up outside and says, give us this guest so that we can have sex with the guest. The old man, not being very chivalrous, said, no, take my guest concubine, and I'll throw in my virgin daughter, and you can have your way with them instead of homosexually raping my guest. Apparently, this old man thought that the laws of hospitality trumped the laws of family and being a father to protect his daughter. So the rapist raped and killed the guest concubine. The guest puts the concubine on his donkey, goes home, cuts the corpse of his concubine into 12 pieces, and sent one piece to each tribe. This is a well-known story. It was a story such that it had never been heard before or since in Israel. It was horrible. It was an atrocity. And so that's why you could just say Gibeah, and everybody knew exactly what you were talking about. All of these events happened in Gibeah, which is a town in Benjamin. From the days of Gibeah you have sinned, O Israel. There they stand. There who stands? Two options. It could be the Benjamites withstood the attacks of the rest of Israel twice because the rest of Israel was pretty upset about what happened down there. And so they attacked Benjamin, and Benjamin fended off those attacks twice, but they succumbed to the third attack, just like the current Israelites are going down to Assyria. That's option number one. Option number two could be the Israelites, the non-Benjamite Israelites, arrayed themselves against Benjamin, and they're still standing after two battles because the Israelites were weak in fighting Benjamin, just like the current Israelites are weak in fighting Assyria. There they stand, pathetic, after two attempts, can't beat the Benjamites. I don't think that's it. I think the reference is to this. O Israel, there they stand, referring to the Benjamites themselves, who are getting ready to be beaten on the third attack, just like the Israelites are getting ready to be beaten by the Assyrians. At the end of verse 9, we read, "Will not the battle against the sons of iniquity overtake them in Gibeah?" Well, it did on the third try. The sons of iniquity, of course, were the Benjamites. And in this case, the reference is to the northern Israelites, who are called, by analogy, the sons of iniquity. Now, reading again the last part of verse 9, "Will not the battle against the sons of iniquity overtake them in Gibeah?" The battle in Gibeah against the Benjamites did not beat the Benjamites till the third engagement. And then the northern Israelites did not overtake all the Benjamites because 600 Benjamites made their escape. Matthew Henry says in his King James English, "But thy sin is worse than theirs, and therefore thou canst not expect but that the battle against the children of iniquity should overtake thee and overcome thee." In other words, just like the Benjamites got wiped out at Gibeah, so the northern Israelites will be wiped out by the Assyrians. We go now to Hosea chapter 10, verse 10. "When it is my desire," and this is God speaking now, and of course it could have been God speaking in the first 9 verses, or it could be Hosea speaking. But if it's God speaking, it's Hosea being the mouthpiece speaking for God. And in verse 10, it's obviously God speaking because he says, "When it is my desire, I will chastise them, and the peoples will be gathered against them when they are bound for their double guilt." When it is my desire, in other words, God's going to choose the time of the punishment. Turns out it was 722. "And the people of northern Israel will be bound for their double guilt." Now, that double guilt is a little bit obscure translation. Let me give you some other translations. The Holman Christian Study Bible and the New American Bible say they will be bound for their two crimes, not double guilt, but two crimes. The ESV has two transgressions. The Bible in Basic English has two sins. The Darby and Young's literal translation have two iniquities. God's Word translation has many sins, not just two sins, but many sins. Well, what are these two crimes, two transgressions? I like those translations better than double guilt. Double guilt sounds like it's an amount. They're doubly guilty of something, but two crimes means two specific sins. Now, let's see what those two sins might be. Here are some options. Option number 1, the two calves in Dan and Bethel. The Holman Christian Study Bible note actually references the establishment of those golden calves in Dan and Bethel, and I think that's what it is. They are bound for their double sin, their two crimes, their two sins, their two calves. The King James has an off-the-wall translation. They are bound for their two furrows. And to explain that, one would say that a heifer is supposed to plow in a straight line. That would be one furrow. But if it wanders to left and right, it creates cross furrows across that straight furrow. So you've got two furrows, one straight and one crossed, and that symbolizes the worship of God and the worship of idolatry. So the two furrows are the two worship situations. One, a worship of Yahweh, and the other, a worship of the golden calf. I don't think so. Here's another option. The two sins, or the two furrows, translating as the King James, are two heifers plowing in contiguous straight lines. In other words, straight lines that are related to each other, parallel in other words. So the Israelites joined themselves in strength as they plow together, but to no avail. I don't think so. Option number 4, the Assyrians will have the Israelites bound side by side, plowing two furrows. They're bound for their two furrows. They're plowing side by side with their two furrows. I don't think so. That's if you take the KJV translation of two furrows. Let's go back to the most probable translation, the two crimes. What are those two crimes? Well, Dan and Bethel, the golden calf in Dan and the golden calf in Bethel could be those two crimes. That was option 1. But option 5 could be the sin at Gibeah plus the golden calf idolatry. The Holman Christian Study Bible note seems to take it that way. Gibeah, of course, remember, is the rape of the concubine. I am equally torn between saying it's the two golden calves, that's the two sins that they're going to get bound for. I'm torn between that option and the option that says it's the two crimes of Gibeah and the golden calf worship, mainly because the context previously, what has just been mentioned, the crime at Gibeah, and right before that, the crime of the golden calves. Now we turn to verse 11 of Hosea 10, and this verse takes up one page of my notes, this little short verse. Pretty obscure, so let's see what we can do with it. God continues, "Ephraim is a trained heifer that loves to thresh. But I will come over her fair neck with a yoke. I will harness Ephraim. Judah will plow. Jacob will harrow for himself. Now we need to look at some agricultural terms before we start. First of all, a heifer. A heifer is a young female cow that is not born a calf. That's according to the Oxford Languages Dictionary. A young female cow that is not born a calf. Now, to thresh means to take grain that has already been harvested, and you run a threshing sled over that grain to knock the chaff away from the grains of wheat. That's done on a threshing floor. Plowing is when you first take the ground and create furrows by running a plowshare through the ground and making the ground make a ditch with dirt piled up on side of the ditch. That's plowing. Harrowing is when you take a round cylindrical looking instrument made out of wood. It's got stones attached to the wood, and you run that harrow over the plowed ground and it breaks up the clods that the plow had turned up. It also smashes the weeds and also covers up any seeds that might have been sown. That's harrowing. Now, verse 11 says that Ephraim is a trained heifer. Trained means that God has trained northern Israel in the ways of the law. Ephraim, of course, is northern Israel. So Ephraim is a legally trained heifer that loves to thresh. Now, why would a cow love to thresh? Well, heifers were used for two purposes, plowing and harrowing too, and threshing, I guess you could say, for three purposes. But the initial use of the heifer was to get the grain ready for growing. So you plow and you harrow. And then once the harvest is made, the grain's put on the threshing floor and the heifers pulled a threshing sled over the grain. Now, threshing was the easier job for two reasons. First, legally, the oxen could not be muzzled so they could eat as they threshed. Of course, the famous verse in Deuteronomy 25:4 says, "Never muzzle an ox when it's threshing grain." So the heifer could eat as he worked. Also, the second reason why a heifer liked threshing more than plowing or harrowing is because the heifers, when they threshed, worked singly, unyoked to other heifers. So they didn't have to worry about their neighbor, as pulpit commentary points out. So threshing is fun, plowing and harrowing is not. So the analogy here is that the Israelites didn't like the yoke of the law. They were trained. Well, the implication is they didn't like the yoke of the law. They were trained, but all they liked to do was thresh. All they liked to do was eat. God's not going to let that continue, though. He's going to come over her fair neck, over Ephraim's fair neck. Ephraim, of course, is likened to a heifer. The fair neck refers to the flourishing and opulent state and condition of the northern ten tribes, especially in the times of Jeroboam II, who ruled from 782 to 753. Ephraim was very prosperous. And so God's going to put a yoke on that prosperous neck. Then, in the last part of verse 11, we have a strange expression. I will harness Ephraim, Judah will plow, Jacob will harrow for himself. All right, Ephraim is the northern kingdom of Israel. Jacob is also another term that's often used for the northern kingdom of Israel, and Judah is the southern kingdom. So now Judah is brought into here. Well, let's start with God's statement that he will harness Ephraim. Options as to what that means. Option number one, God will be Ephraim's ruler and director. This is Benson's view, just a general statement that God's going to direct Ephraim from now on. Ellicott and Poole says that this refers to the fact that the Assyrians will soon conquer Israel. I will harness Ephraim by turning the Assyrians loose on northern Israel. Option number three is God will keep Ephraim from harming Judah. Remember, northern Israel fought Judah several times back in the book of Kings and Chronicles. I think it's just simpler to say that God is going to harness Ephraim, not refer it back to contest with Judah, but rather to the coming conflict with Assyria. God's going to take control of Ephraim, and they're not going to be eating the grain on the threshing floor anymore. Now, before I attempt to give an overall interpretation of verse 11, let's take the last phrase as it is translated here in the New American Standard Bible. Jacob will harrow for himself. Let me give you some other translations. The Holman Christian Study Bible says Jacob will do the final plowing. Well, that sounds like harrowing. You plow first, then you harrow second, so the final plowing is like harrowing. The American Standard Version, Darby, and the King James Version says Jacob shall break his clods. That's what a harrow does. It breaks the clods of earth that were formed by the plowing. The New American Bible says, break his furrows. That means to harrow. Young's Literal Translation says, harrow for him doth Jacob. Young's Literal Translation actually uses the word harrow. So all the translations make it sound like the meaning is to harrow, not harrow for himself. So let's don't try to interpret harrow for himself. Some versions have Jacob will harrow for him for Judah, which doesn't make any sense either to me. So we're just going to take it very simply as Jacob, northern Israel, will do the harrowing. So, now with that behind us, let's look at some options as to the meaning of the whole verse. Option number one, Ephraim, though trained in the law, likes to do only fun stuff, threshing. But Yahweh is going to make them, along with Judah, do hard work. Northern Israel will be harnessed, as the verse says, and northern Israel will do the harrowing. Judah will do the plowing. So northern Israel and Judah will do all the hard work. So basically, this is another prophecy of saying bad times are coming, and Judah is mentioned along with northern Israel. Hosea does that a lot, throws Judah in while he's denouncing northern Israel. He'll just throw Judah in. I think it was chapters 5 that he did that, and chapter 6 he did that. Now there's another possible way to interpret this verse, option number 2. Benson mentions this as an option. The Ephraimites will be finally converted and restored to prosperity. The plowing and harrowing will be done for the sake of prosperity. It's not hard work, but it's what we're going to get from that hard work. The problem with this is that the whole context is judgment in this chapter, not blessing. Now, there's an exception to that, verse 12. Sow with a view to righteousness, reap in accordance with kindness, break up your fallow ground, for it is time to seek the Lord until he comes to rain righteousness on you. So there's one positive verse, but the whole rest of the chapter is about judgment, judgment, judgment. So I believe that the way we interpret verse 11 is that God's going to harness Ephraim so that Ephraim will harrow. Judah's going to do the plowing. Hard work's ahead. So all that fun time that northern Israel had in threshing, those days are over. We go now to Hosea 10, verses 12 through 14. Sow with a view to righteousness, reap in accordance with kindness. Break up your fallow ground, for it is time to seek the Lord until he comes to rain righteousness on you. Verse 12 is just saying, fly right, northern Israel. Verse 13, you have plowed wickedness, you have reaped injustice, you have eaten the fruit of lies. Notice the progression. You plow, that's when you plant wickedness. Then you reap, that's after wickedness has grown up and created a harvest, and it's a harvest of injustice. So you reap the harvest of injustice, and then you eat the fruit of lies. So wickedness, injustice, and the fruit of lies is all involved here because you have trusted in your way and your numerous warriors. Therefore, a tumult will arise among your people, and all your fortresses will be destroyed. And that, of course, is referring to the destruction of northern Israel by Shalmaneser V in 722. Now, this destruction of the fortresses of northern Israel will be like when Shalman destroyed Beth Arbel on the day of battle when mothers were dashed in pieces with their children. Now, this is an obscure reference, this Shalman destroying Beth Arbel. Ellicott says the allusion is very obscure. So let me give you three options as to what might be referenced here. Option number one is just unknown. We'll never know, so forget it. Option number two, and this is from Ellicott. He mentions this as an option. This is referring to Gilman defeating Zalmunna, who was the general of the Midianites. Well, how in the world that's got to do with Shalman destroying Beth Arbel is something that I don't know because I think it's such a stretch that I haven't investigated it, so I don't know what that is. I think option number three is your best bet. Shalman, which is short for Shalmaneser V, is when he destroyed Beth Arbel. When might he have done that? Well, he campaigned in Lebanon in 775, and he campaigned in Damascus in 773, and then it's reasonable to speculate that he came on down to the Transjordan area east of the Jordan River near Pella, the famous Pella, where the Christians in the siege of Jerusalem in AD 70 escaped to. Arbela is a town near there, and so Shalman could have destroyed Beth Arbel in one of those two campaigns. That's reasonable enough. But I think here's an even better option, referring to when Shalmaneser V attacked Israel, which would include Bethel. I'm going to have to equate Beth Arbel to Bethel, the famous town in the south of Ephraim where the golden calf was. I'll do that in a minute. But assuming that Beth Arbel is Bethel, as Shalman destroyed Bethel on the day of battle, we can see that in 2 Kings 17:3-5. Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, attacked Hoshea, and Hoshea became his vassal and paid him tribute money. But the king of Assyria discovered Hoshea's conspiracy. Hoshea had sent envoys to So, king of Egypt, and had not paid tribute money to the king of Assyria as in previous years. Therefore, the king of Assyria, that's Shalmaneser V, arrested him and put him in prison. Then the king of Assyria invaded the whole land, marched up to Samaria, and besieged it for 3 years. And so the speculation is that during this invasion, during the final 3 years of the northern kingdom of Israel, during that invasion, Shalmaneser V wiped out Bethel. Well, as Poole says, whatever this destruction of Beth Arbel is referring to, its particulars were well known to the Israelites, of course. It's just to us that we have confusion. Well, if I had to guess, I would say this is when Shalmaneser V sounds like a nickname, a shortened version of Shalmaneser V. And then Beth Arbel, we can equate to Bethel this way. The word itself means the house of ambush of God, as Barnes points out. So this is a good allusion to Bethel, which means house of God. Ephraim had already turned Bethel into Beth-Aven, house of God into house of wickedness, and so now they turned the house of wickedness into the house of the ambush of God by inviting the Assyrians into their country by being stupid. And so Beth Arbel would just be a symbolic name for Bethel. I think that makes a lot of sense. Now here's some other options as to what Beth Arbel might mean. Option number one, the name of a man whose house and family Shalman destroyed. Poole mentions that as an option. Poole also mentions it could be a place name, the house of Mr. Arbel, or the house of a place called Arbel. But as I've already said, I like Barnes's view that Beth Arbel is referring to Bethel, Bethel being referred to as the house of ambush of God. It was ambushed because the northern Israelites, because of their sin, because of Hoshea's stupidity, had managed to get Shalmaneser V to come invade the kingdom and destroy the golden calf altar at Bethel. We go now to Hosea 10:15, and we will finish this chapter. Hosea, Yahweh speaking through Hosea, says, "Thus it will be done to you at Bethel." Now you see, I'm just talking about Beth Arbel, and then all of a sudden right here in verse 15, Bethel, the context seems to me that Beth Arbel is Bethel. "Thus it will be done to you at Bethel because of your great wickedness. At dawn, the king of Israel will be completely cut off." Now, if Beth Arbela is not Bethel, or Beth Arbel is not Bethel, then verse 15 is saying that the northern Israelites will get wiped out at Bethel just like the people of Beth Arbel got wiped out at Beth Arbel. I don't believe that's it. I believe that Bethel is just a synonym for Beth Arbel. "So it will be done to you because of your great wickedness. At dawn, the king of Israel will be completely cut off." At dawn, options as to what that might mean. Option number one, it would certainly be done as sure as the morning comes. Option number two, it will come suddenly and quickly, this cutting off of Israel. It will be done suddenly and quickly as the morning light suddenly and quickly breaks forth out of the nighttime. Option number three, in the morning of prosperity, when they were expecting light and good days from their alliance with the king of Egypt and against the king of Assyria. Whoops! Shalmaneser V shows up, like the breaking of the dawn. Well, whatever it means quickly the king of Israel will be completely cut off. And, of course, with Hoshea's demise, he ruled from 732 to 722. After 722, there were no more kings in Israel. And so now we are finished with the punishment of northern Israel in chapter 10. In our next audio, we will have some good news. Chapter 11 will discuss the Lord's love for Israel. I've said this many, many times. The prophets always preach doom and gloom against Israel, and then they finish off by saying, "But God loves you. If you repent and come back, wonderful times ahead." So we'll see some good times ahead in chapter 11. I hope you stay tuned with me for that discussion, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.